You're listening to In Conversation With, a podcast that discusses timely issues related to sheep and crops. I'm Kirsten Williams, and in this episode, we're going to discuss management of grass and water for the summer with Poppy Frater from SEC and Kerr Adams from James Hutton Institute. Okay, so today we have got two fantastic guests along. We have got Poppy. Good morning, Poppy.
Good morning.
And we have got Kerr. Hi, Kerr.
Hi, Kirsten. Great to be here.
So I think it's quite fair to say we have had a rather challenging spring, haven't we? It's been very wet. Winter has been wet, a delayed spring, which has meant a delay in our kind of preparations for groundwork, hasn't it? And our harrowing, our rolling, it's all just taken a bit longer. And I think it's we're now officially in May, which means we can talk about summer. It's nearly June. And I think it's great to kind of plan ahead and think about how we actually manage our grass to make best use of it and to increase our utilisation. And we have got the ultimate grass guru here today in Poppy. And I would love to hear, Poppy, that as we go into June or the summer, how do we actually make best use of our pasture?
Yeah, thanks, Kirsten. Many of you that will have heard me speaking before know I am a big fan of rotational grazing. And the reason I'm a big fan of rotational grazing is mainly, there's many benefits, but the biggest benefit is that you're utilising more of the grass you grow on farm, so less of it is going to waste. And I think that's becoming more relevant as we head into this very variable weather extremes as it gets drier or wetter. And grass supply might be affected by that. It gets more important to try and make the most of anything that does grow and utilise it well. So I am a big fan of rotational grazing in any form. So that might be farmers just moving stock from field to field on a sort of weekly basis. There's a benefit to that. To those that are moving them sort of every day, which we know there are greater benefits to more frequent moving because you're giving the animals less opportunity to waste.
Let's talk about the three leaf rule, because it's I always like your infographic that you use that just makes it make sense. So I'm going to challenge you to make it make sense without an infographic.
Okay. So, I mean, the three leaf rule, I think it was, well, I first heard of it over in Australia, and a lot of them were talking about actually counting the leaves, and it's not something I advocate here. But basically, a ryegrass plant or a tiller can only really have three leaves at any one time. So what happens after it's been grazed or cut, a tiller will put up one new leaf, and then the second new leaf, and then the third. But then as that fourth leaf starting to grow, that first leaf dies. So that represents a wasted feed opportunity. It represents a buildup of dead material on the sward, which can stop light getting to the base of the grass. But also, if you're thinking, and as I think of the sward as the ration that these animals are getting, it just reduces the energy density of the ration. So therefore, what they're being faced with is poorer quality.
Well done. I think you summed that up quite nicely there, Poppy. So when you've got your three leaves, and it's having that sweet spot, isn't it? It's having the most nutritionous. And when it gets up, we've got our heading date that we speak about. When we get to the heading date, the grass loses its sweetness. It loses its digestibility and its nutrition, doesn't it? So how do we manage it to have these target heights? What is the sweet spot?
Yeah. Very simply, I would say the sweet spot is between 6 and 8 centimetres. So for those that are set stocking, and there are valid instances where set stocking is fine, keeping that grass in between these heights of 6 to 8 centimetres, that's your sweet spot. For those that are rotationally grazing, you're going in at around the sort of 8 to 10 centimetres, and you're taking them out at the 4 to 5 centimetres. I've done sort of demonstrations with coke cans. So coke can on end is the sort of target height when you go in, and coke can on its side would be the target height for removing animals.
And it doesn't just have to be a Coke can, it can be an Iron Brew can. Have you seen any other different ways that people, I've seen people that like have a line on their welly and that line is go in or go out. Have you seen anything else that people have used that's quite easy and quick tricks?
A more crude one was when you sort of see the sheep poo or, you know, when you can see that the grass isn't quite reaching the height of the sheep poo across the field, that's a sign that they should be moved. I wouldn't say that's probably not the word the farmer used, but yeah, there's all sorts of things, all sorts of rules.
Well saved, I would say, well saved. And like most people will be finished lambing time, and when I say value of rest, I think I'm talking about both the human and the field, because it has, like I said at the start, it's been pretty challenging. And this value of rest, we'll start with the grass, because the value of rest for grass is huge. But I think while saying value of rest, we have to think about actually humans as well, and that people should take a break and get off farm and make sure that they're having a rest. And a bit like the grass, that you rest it recharges, the sun beats into it, it's a little solar panel. And I think that's quite similar for humans as well. So talk to us, Poppy, about value of rest. Let's talk about grass.
Well, I like to talk about them both, because often when I do advocate rotational grazing, people say that sounds like a lot of work, and I don't want to give people more work. I want farmers to have the opportunity to take weekends away, holidays away. So the two absolutely need to be thought alongside one another. I'll start with the grass, because through rotational grazing gives you that option to rest the grass. So when I'm talking back to the three leaf rule, one of the downsides of the whole game is that first new leaf is higher in energy than the subsequent leaves. And sheep, cattle less so, but sheep are very, very selective, and they will find these sweeties of the pasture, these first new shoots, and they will go for them. And that will constantly put pressure on the grass plant. And that will mean that grass plant will less likely to persist in the long term. So for the plant species on the grass, we want to rest. And then in addition, when you're thinking about the roots below the ground, whenever the grass is grazed, there is the same sort of loss in matter below the ground. So loss of leaf above the ground, there's loss in roots below the ground. So if it's constantly put into pressure, you're not getting the same amount of roots forming beneath the ground. So again, grazing it to the sort of 5 centimeters, resting it, I say it's sort of a textbook guide to the start, but it has to be flexible. But resting for around 3 weeks would be my sort of plan to start with. It just enables those roots to recover well. So then that plant can still, as we might be going into a, you know, water scarcity or whatever, that plant can still draw up as much water as possible, and alongside nutrients as well. Back to people rest. That's why if you're going into rotational grazing, setting it up so that there is less need to move fences through the summer. Setting it up, you know, I've seen people put Alkatheme pipe on the front of their quad so that they can drive over the electric fencing, so they're not having to get up and move. I really am a fan of making things as labor efficient as possible, and that might mean investing as well in better quality fencing as well.
And we had a discussion, didn't we, the other day, Poppy, where you referred to it as lazy farming, which I took ambush to, and I said it's labor efficient farming. You can't call farmers lazy.
Oh, absolutely not. I wasn't referring to that. I mean that so there's a, I think it was a Steve Jobs quote, or I might have that wrong. But anyways, it was, if I have a really complicated task, I'll give it to the laziest person to do, because they'll do it the most efficiently. And I think there's something to that. You know, the laziest, maybe lazy isn't the right word, but those that are keen and forward thinking when it comes to their energy will often think of the most efficient ways to get things done.
So that's, I think that's some really, really interesting stuff there between your three leaf rule, your target height, your the ultimate value of rest, and these ensuring you've got the roots, because without the roots you don't have a healthy plant, without the healthy plant you don't have healthy stock, and it's all about performance. Like that's the aim, isn't it, that we've got healthy stock that are performing very well and therefore are being profitable, which leads to a happy life, doesn't it? But I think when we've got loads of grass, there's loads of stuff we can do. We can top it, we can cut silage, we can close it off for deferred grazing. Like there's so many options, isn't there? But on the flip side, when we have too little, and we've seen a couple of years when we have had too little grass, if we've had like water shortages, and we do have a change in climate, like it's very clear to see, and this year has demonstrated it amazingly, hasn't it? And Kerr, we have recently worked together on a project looking at this very thing, haven't we? And the effect of the changing climate and water availability. And it feels really, like the whole project to me felt really weird talking about water scarcity in the wettest winter possible. But it changes so fast, and it can change so fast. And I'm hoping the fact that we're talking about this, that usually Poppy will agree with me here, when we talk about something or write an article on something, it does the opposite. So let's talk about lack of water and the hope that we just have a perfect growthy summer season. Let's hope for that. But like Kerr, I think when we're talking about grass, it relies on rainfall and groundwater, doesn't it? So what are the trends? What does it look like? What does the future look like? It's a big question, isn't it? I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what's the trends telling us?
Yeah, well, we recently completed that 6 months project that you mentioned, Kirsten, and yeah, since it started in November, I think right through, it rained the whole way through. So speaking of, giving farmers a break, I'm with you and hoping that this summer is favourable conditions. However, our projections are within the project, looking at what we call a climatic water balance. So the difference between precipitation and evapotranspiration. So if your precipitation is greater, then you're likely to be in a surplus of water. Evapotranspiration is greater, then yeah, you're likely to be in a stronger deficit. And within that, we're looking at kind of extremes. So the climate projections show that from October through to March, are likely across Scotland to be in surplus, with some areas being in greater surplus. So that's what we see with the wet March, likely to continue into the future. But then in the summer switches, and well, actually into early spring, and now looking into future projections to 2050, are actually looking into September of being more in deficit, but more extreme deficits in months such as June, July, and August. And you know, historically that's been around the east coast to the northeast of Scotland, and certainly in recent years, as you mentioned, starting to see more challenges with grassland growth, but that's also likely to extend more centrally and out into the Outer Hebrides and these sorts of areas as well. So yeah, these deficits are going to have implications for grassland growth, particularly in key growth stages. But we've had the really interesting part of the project was being able to go out and speak with farmers to understand, you know, how the water is so important for grassland growth, and what these future projections mean for them. So I spoke to farmers in the northeast of Scotland, and then with the support of NFU Scotland, spoke to livestock farmers across the country. Really highlighted, you know, that they are aware of the challenge. It's likely to become more challenging in the future. So it's looking at those different adaptation options within the project as well. And great to have experts like yourself, Kirsten, in the project, are able to translate that evidence and what the farmers are telling us into effective communication and adaptation projects for that is outputs for that project as well. It's interesting to hear about the what Poppy's talking, the three leaf project, and the importance of getting, you know, strong root growth. So yeah, it'd be interesting to hear how these different kind of grazing strategies and the three leaf demonstration can help address the issue of.
It's really interesting, Kerr, because you have done a massive literature review for this, and the report is so impressive. And we'll link anything onto the show notes with references there. One thing that really stood out to me when I was reading it was you've got a water footprint that you'd find in your literature reviews for the different classes of stock. And I've written it down so I don't get it wrong, but the water footprint for a sheep is 8,763 meter cube per ton, but only 1.1% is that used for drinking. The rest of that is used for feed. So your grass, you're growing your barley, it's phenomenal. It's a huge amount of water.
It is, yeah, absolutely. And yeah, those were global figures, averages, I think from across Europe. It'd be interesting to see that more in a Scottish perspective and understanding how much water is used and the different types of agricultural processes. That could be something that got for the future, because ultimately that helps with your management in these situations. But it's a lot of water, and some surprising outcomes from our focus group now. Water is used. We thought maybe mainly crops would have been rain fed, but there is people out there that are irrigating and using water for what we call more traditional rain fed crops. A lot of water, both out in the field but also in house as well.
And it's amazing how much we rely on water. I think we've never had 2018, 2021, we've had years that we've had a lack of water, but we're generally, we don't worry, do we? We just use it. Whereas if you speak to, say, the Australians, they guard it like it's precious gold. You don't waste it. If you're brushing your teeth, you turn the tap off. You don't leave it running. I think it's a luxury to us that we're just used to having. And it's when somebody turns that tap off, you realise how much we use it on a farm. And even just now, crops are growing, most livestock are outside, but then we've still got our intensive agriculture. We've got our dairy cows that need their parlour washed down every day. We've got pigs and poultry who rely on that water coming to them. It's quite phenomenal how much water as an industry we use. It was quite nice to see that, yes, we're reliant on it, but by goodness, the distilleries are also very reliant on it. And it's so interesting just to see how we use this natural resource that we're just so used to having, that we curse at times, especially after this winter, but we're actually quite lucky to have it as well. And I think that kind of, that as an industry, we adapt, we change. And Kerr, you were saying there about like there's people actually irrigating crops, and it's great if you've got the irrigation equipment there already. It gives you an option, doesn't it? And I think as well, when you're talking about three leaf rule, and there's loads of kind of strategies that we can do and how we can adapt our farming practices in a way as well. And Poppy, there's some things like species rich multi-species swards that play a really nice part here as well, isn't there? You've done a bit of work and looking into the literature with those. How do they help?
Anything that brings roots into the soil, anything that brings organic matter into the soil, just means that we store it in the landscape, which is it's a much more sustainable way of storing the soil than in tanks and having to actually spread it yourself. If you can store it in the soils and make as much of it, whatever's there in the soils, by increasing that sponge of organic matter and increasing the root depth. So multi-species swards generally, they've got such a, with diversity, you've above ground, you've got the diversity below ground. So they're using more of the like the niches within the soil. So more of the that environment is captured with these just different types of roots.
And they're really nice because they're so deep rooting. So as well as being a sponge and getting the water, they're improving the soil as well, aren't they? And they're super nutritious. So it's like win-win-win from everywhere. And like sheep specifically, they love a herb, don't they? So
yeah, there's plenty of multiple benefits there, and that came through quite a lot when we were speaking with farmers. Not only effective in, you know, water shortage situations, but also in terms of flooding and holding, attenuating the water in the landscape as well.
And it's having that water holding capacity, but not going off the switch as well. Whereas in the winter, the soil's not managed, and again, it's the benefit that these crops actually make for increasing the organic matter, which then makes the soil more resilient to big downpours or no water, doesn't it? So it's trying to find these and see how they actually fit in with the system and the benefits that they bring. And I guess even if you're 100% arable, that these crops still have a place, and your catch crops and everything else still have a place, don't they?
Yeah, like with arable, I mean, we're so lucky in the grassland world in a way, because when you're not disturbing the soil as much anyways and things, you're more likely have greater amounts of organic matter. But there are still things you can do. There's loads you can do in the arable world to try and keep that organic matter in the soil. But yeah, like you say, cover crops, making sure there's minimal bare soil over the year, and minimal tillage as well.
There's also the big thing you're missing, and that is that sheep are the solution, Poppy, isn't it? Sheep are the solution, because if you're arable and you grow cover crops, something's got to eat it. You know, you've got to, sheep are the answer, definitely. Kerr, was there any other kind of, from the focus groups and discussion groups, was there any other nice kind of things that people were doing that just helped build the resilience? So we've spoken about like some multi-species swards. What about having somewhere to keep water to harvest it?
Yeah, so there was quite a few people in the focus groups mentioned, particularly from we're looking at the livestock sector, was rainwater harvesting. So the rainwater that's, you know, coming off sheds and roofs. It won't take all your water, won't cover all your water demand, but you can always increase your storage. I think it's very dependent on the sector. So for the, particularly the horticulture sector, increased offline storage in lagoons is a bit more viable than for example, if you have for growing grassland or even for growing some crops. So there's no one solution fits all, but it was nice to hear that there was, people were already adapting and protecting the livestock sector with, yeah, the harvesting of rainwater. And that's transferable to, for example, the distillery sector, where if you harvest rainwater, they then have to treat it for use in your product. But, you know, harvesting from sheds and on farm can be good for cleaning purposes and these sorts of things. So it's an extra layer of resilience, particularly when potential impacts of groundwater storage and recharge, which we found in the report too, could have an implication of private water supplies. So there's a way of building your resilience.
So for speaking of resilience, the report also covers, we're obviously more looking at livestock here, but it does cover the irrigated crops and the distillers, who are really high reliance. I know, like livestock, I've seen that for sheep, the mass amount. But the levels there, I can't remember exactly what it was, but per litre of whiskey, it's massive how much water that's used, but it is recycled, isn't it? What have they done that we can learn off?
Well, so found in the distilling sector, they're doing quite a lot of innovation, technical innovation, which is encouraging to hear. So they use water the abstraction of water, and they'll use a license to abstract water either from groundwater and springs for the product, the actual product than the alcohol. So that's around 10 to 5%, whereas the rest of the water is abstracted for cooling purposes. So it is returned, but the water is abstracted at one point and then returned at another. But they're looking at ways of reducing that reliance on coolant water through different innovations, which requires a lot less water for coolant. So that was quite encouraging. Again, if the distillery allows, they have the space for that, they can look at offline storage as well.
It amazes me how we have this natural resource that we just take for granted, really, don't we? And it's tech has got such a big place. I'm such a believer in tech and that it can help with efficiencies throughout, can't it, performance and profitability at the end of the day as well. But I think we have to learn from others, don't we? If others have had the issue, the problem, we have to learn and adapt. And it's been covered quite heavily in the press of late that New Zealand has had a really, really bad drought. It's lasted something like 5 or 6 months. Like it's a long duration. And I know they have a very different climate from us, but their farming systems are quite alike in that they're cattle and sheep, they're grassland focused. And I think there's so much we can learn of how they have adapted. You've obviously got the mental health side of it, that you have to find people that you can talk to, trusted advisors, trusted people that you can just pick up the phone and have a yarn with, but also that you're actually physically getting off the farm and you just walk away from the problem for a couple of hours and just do something that makes you happy or that just reduces the problem a little bit. But I think there's also a big part in making management decisions off it as well, and that can you destock? Do you need to have as much stock on the holding? And we've kind of looked at that as well, Poppy, haven't we? When there's been years that we've had, say, forage shortages, that try and prioritise the breeding stock, whereas quite often late summer they're the lowest priority, aren't they? And it's all about the growing stock. But there's that ability just to destock. Who needs to be here? Who is the priority? And it works for cattle and sheep, doesn't it? But there's also thinking about do you bring feed sources in? What is more profitable to do? What has higher risk? Which is actually quite challenging to look forward to now, Poppy, isn't it? When we've had lambs at the premium that they're at, to sell them maybe when other people are trying to offload as well, knowing that we've possibly got a shortage coming through the turn of the year. So it does make it tricky, and that's having those trusted people around you, isn't it, that you can just bounce those ideas off. And I think it is, it just gives huge value just to understand how other people have addressed it or tackled it. And Poppy, again, like, you used to be in New Zealand, didn't you? You worked for a company out there, Farmax, and it is their software, you can maybe explain it, but it's very much looking at supply and demand and how you can manage risk, or that when I asked Cara earlier if he had a crystal ball, it's almost a thing that gives you a little bit of a tool to have that crystal ball. Do you want to explain a little bit how that could help?
Yeah, you're right, because farmers in a dry year when things are getting hard, we need to, I mean, it's common sense, but we need to be flexible. And so Farmax is a tool that just helps reinforce your decision making. So a lot of the time as a farmer, you'll probably already know, sort of have a bit of an idea of where you need to be going, but it takes a bit of confidence to make these bold decisions, you know, selling a bunch of your ewes, for instance, or getting rid of lamb store. These are big decisions and it can take a bit of confidence. So Farmax, what it does is it brings together all the information that farmers have to bring together in their heads. I don't know how they do it, but it brings it all together in a software tool. So bringing together the price of lamb through the year, bring together the feed these animals require, the feed available on the farm, the cost of any other feeds that may need to be bought in if needs be, cost of fertilizer, things like that. So that when the time comes, if it looks like you're in a, facing a problem into the future, it integrates all this data, so you can work out which option is going to cost you the least. Is it going to be the least cost to buy and feed? Is it going to be the least cost just to sell some store? Is it going to be the least cost just to suffer their weights now, but perhaps sell them later? That's what Pharmax does. Just helps you weigh up with all this information that you have to do, weigh up in your head. You talk about, mental health there. No wonder there's mental health issues when we're struggling with such a variable climate and you're having to do all these calculations in your head. No wonder. And so being able to get that out on paper, out with somebody else at least, or in a piece of software, just helps, helps you know that you're making these decisions, which are hard decisions, based on something, based on some evidence.
And it's a great tool, isn't it? Just to be able to do that forward thinking, because it's very easy to firefight, isn't it? But it's thinking, and it's almost like planning in the winter for the autumn, isn't it? That if it is dry, have I done enough? Have I got the forage crops in that's built a big stack of forage just sitting there ready? It's deep rooting. It will cope in a drought. It's having those scenarios, but then understanding this is the yield I've got, this is the stock I've got, how many can I carry? And it's scenario planning, isn't it?
Yeah. So some farmers were looking out to even winter next year. We're able to look out that far ahead, with obviously the further we look out, the less confidence we have, but it's, based on sort of averages. But then also, more importantly, we're looking out to this summer, and constantly with added pasture information, you're reforecasting. And that's where you see the problem sort of potentially a month ahead, 6 weeks ahead.
And with that kind of supply and demand curves that you get off it, can you give it the scenario of July, we're going to have a very low rainfall? Can you give it that kind of stats that then it reshuggles itself and says, well, this is how much stock you can have. This is a get a plan B sorted that you can really throw stuff at it and it'll just react.
Yeah, I'm quite an advocate of that, of stress testing the plan. Should the worst happen, this is how it's going to look. What are we going to do? Yeah.
It's brilliant to be able to do that, though. Absolutely brilliant. And I think just when I use forage crops there, I think that's another lovely way that we've had a late spring. If there's land that has not managed to get into, say, barley or something, forage crops are a lovely thing to add in there. You can have your quick growing crops that take like 10 to 12 weeks. You've got your slower growing crops. But again, if you pick ones that have got a lovely deep taproot, it's doing all this sponge effect, plus building that bank of forage, which is really nice as well. One thing we've not spoken about, though, is, like, we've looked at looking forward and how to plan. One thing we've not spoken about is cash flow. And I think that's something else that's actually really important to do. Just try and see what it looks like. And the likes of that, is it a destocking scenario? Having a cash flow for the next 12 months just lets you see where those highs and lows are of income and expenditure. And again, you can monitor it. You can change it at any time as well. And it's just another tool that you can have in the toolkit. And there's some fantastic resources on the Farm Advisory Service website that's got like cash flow tools. It's got drought resilience tools. There's one really nice video actually, Care, and it's going back to what you're speaking about the rainwater harvesting. And there's a nice video and it actually uses Lanark Market, because they've got a huge amount of water requirement for every sale they're having to wash out. And again, it's a big old roof. it's a lot of rain. It's in the west, so it rains a lot. And it's just businesses thinking differently, isn't it? That they've invested in the resilience going forward, that in a dry summer that they don't get stuck as such, which it's great. And it's having that, I guess it's that space and time, isn't it, to just be able to stop and say, right, what would have made my life easier? And learn off of that. We're in May now. Have a think back. Actually, what have I done in the last 2 or 3 weeks? that just took me dead time, that if I just change one little thing, that I'm actually going to make my life easier next May. And it's giving yourself time to think, which is never very easy, is it? But it's rewarding to change that one little thing that actually makes a really big impact.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Because you're talking there about the tool also includes that kind of more shorter term planning, but hopefully resources and looking at the project and water scarcity, also thinking about the long term and the adaptation. Because what's became really apparent, and both yourself and Poppy have mentioned it, is just how many decisions you have to make in your head as a farmer, and with, you know, rising input costs, climate variability, it's, you know, almost taking that stress out of it with these maybe longer term scenarios. What changes can I make now to take that stress, not just for me but for my future generations? I think that's, yeah, really important to look not just at the short term decisions you can make, but the long term. And I think it's that in terms of valuing the water as well. So you can make those little small decisions, so having a real holistic understanding of water use right across your processes. So being able to measure that and understand that, so because there can be small wins that can help, you know, take that stress away. But there's also those larger infrastructural changes that you can make, for example, with, well, maybe not too large with rainwater harvesting, and maybe a medium level intervention that you can take. But with everything, yeah, you need support for these sorts of things. So there is schemes out there, but yeah, I think there's certainly room for making it a little bit easier to access that funding to make maybe these more medium to larger changes. But also at the farm level, getting that better understanding of how water's used and how that's kind of crucial to your business, and making small changes there is also kind of equally important too.
It is. It's having that understanding, because I don't think there'd be many people that you could say, "What's your water usage in a year?" I don't think many people would be able to answer that, would they? Or
yeah, that came through quite a bit. People on, for example, if they're licensed, they'll have maybe more of a understanding of, you know, how long irrigation pump's been running, and they have to do a return to SEPA. But for people who the different levels of registration in GBR, some people might not know what kind of level that they're on. There's not that requirement for recording water use. But I wouldn't see it more as a requirement for regulation, just more as, you know, understanding business risk within that. So just to maybe understand your water uses across the different processes would be really helpful for building resilience, but then understanding how you're using that water.
And there would be sensors available that say you could put on a water trough and just understand what the water use is. I don't know, you've got a field of 30 cows, say, what is their water use, and then times it up by how many you've got. And yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, to understand how much we use the natural resource.
And that was the difference between some of the sectors, for example, in the distilling sector, understanding how water passes through the process. They really wanted to understand that, and they are putting these sensors in place to understand where they can make efficiency, where they can make savings. So that's really important. They are a different type of business, of course, but it could be something that the agricultural community could look at to help improve decision making. Yeah.
Great. And just to sum up our conversation, I guess, is I'm gonna put you both on the spot because I can, and it's I'm just wondering, what is your absolute key message going forward? So Poppy, what is your absolute key message for going forward into the summer for managing grass supplies?
I guess it's look at ways in which you could integrate rest into your pasture management. And like I say, whether that's moving animals just a bit more frequently, even if it's splitting a field in half and resting half the field and moving them from one to the next, that will still benefit the resilience of your grass and your soils.
Brilliant. And Kerr, what about your key message on managing water supplies going forward for the summer?
I guess going forward for the summer coming, I think my key message is almost don't delay. Start thinking that you know, potential water shortages, not just this year coming, but moving into the future. So I think taking it kind of seriously, and a lot of people are water scarcity and water shortages are moving up the agenda. But I guess it's trying to understand that risk. Don't delay in trying to understand that risk to your business, and identifying ways in which you can, you know, limit that risk to your business. There's lots of great information out there, as you mentioned, with the Farm Advisory Service, Farming and Water Scotland. Hopefully, with the Centre of Expertise for Waters, they've done a great series on water scarcity. So our projects is just one. University of Dundee have been looking at it holistically in terms of water scarcity. The University of Aberdeen, the James Hutton Institute, have been looking at it for private water supplies. So it is moving up the agenda. There will be information out there. Now it's all about, you know, how do we enable the change or the transformation that's needed to help adapt to water scarcity? And one way of doing that is, you know, collaboration amongst your peers. So, yeah, I think I've probably went with about 5 messages there, but I sneaked a few in. But my key one would be, don't delay on acting on this.
Brilliant. And I think I started thinking it was really cruel actually asking you that, and I was thinking I better think of one as well, so it's not just quite as cruel. But I think mine would be just to try and surround yourself with people that can help make sensible decisions, balanced decisions as well, and just the importance of talking and just sense checking with people. I really hope though that now we have addressed this topic, that we're going to have the most growthy summer. We're going to, when I said there's loads of options when there's too much, so let's hope we have loads of silage, that we have loads of deferred grazing shut off for winter, and it's just the perfect season after the winter and spring that we've had. So thank you guys for coming to speak to us today. We have covered so much and it's been so interesting. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Nice chatting with you both.
Thanks for joining us for this show of In Conversation With. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please like, follow and subscribe to our new show. If you've enjoyed listening to In Conversation With, you may enjoy some of our other podcasts, such as Stock Talk. Come back next month when we are back to crops with Mark, and he'll be joined by John Sterling from our Bicky Distillery.
The Farm Advisory Service Podcast. Audio advice on livestock, crops and soils, environment, rural business, and more. Brought to you in association with the Scottish Government.